Thank you, dear listener, for your kind attention to this pointless rambling. Forever Night is episodic, but this podcast is not. You're best served by starting at the introduction and going through an order. Thanks. Let's begin, shall we? Welcome to Still Dreaming, an existential journey through our forever night. Welcome, gentle listener, to episode 3 of Still Dreaming, an existential wandering through our forever night. Tonight we look at the third installment of the series entitled For I Have Sinned. The synopsis for this episode, appropriated from Wikipedia, reads like this. Nick and Skanky investigate a series of gruesome crimes against women. When medical examiner Natalie finds crosses on the women's bodies, Nick flashes back to 15th century France, where he encounters Joan of Arc. Linking the crimes to the Catholic Church, Nick attempts to find the killer, but is prevented by his aversion to crosses and a priest determined to keep confession sacred. So, before I watched this episode, I made a few thoughts, a recording of my thoughts, just based on the synopsis alone. So let's take a listen to what I was thinking then. So, Nick met Joan of Arc. Of course he did. It wouldn't be a vampire show if he didn't meet every single person from history, would it? Well, anyway, a few thoughts before I actually watched the episode. So, I'm coming to you from the past before I've actually watched episode 3. I don't remember this just from the synopsis, but there's great potential here, of course. A vampire in a church? Talking to a priest about confessions? Come on, that's gotta be good. And if I remember right, Nick was a crusader in his human life, wasn't he? He's got to have conflicting emotions about the Roman Catholic faith. So the synopsis makes it sound like Natalie will have a role to play in this as well, and obviously that makes me happy. I'm looking forward to watching it and figuring out exactly what road I want to go down with it. Just as a little peek behind the scenes, I have an idea of what I want to do with the existentialism in this series. I don't really make up my mind on what text I'm going to dive into until I watch the episode, although I kind of cheated that with the first episode, the pilot. But that's likely how it's going to go from here on. So now I'm off to go give it a watch. Let's see what I think. So now that I have watched it, and before we dive in fully, let me just preface this by saying at first I was really disappointed. There was so much promise, so unfulfilled. I mean, Nick was in the Crusades. How can we have an entire episode about the church, faith, coming to God, moral hypocrisy, and never mention that Nick was in the Crusades? Man, I really wanted him to open up with some war stories to Natalie, but no. Overall, I found this episode flat and anticlimactic, and definitely a weak follow-up to the pilot, which, as you recall, I rather liked. But I found, as I let the memory of the episode simmer in the back of my mind, and began diving into the research I wanted to do, I warmed up to it a little, very little, but somewhat warmer nonetheless. That's because the theme of unsatisfying endings, spoilers for this episode, is a theme of this podcast. Because more often than not, it's a theme of life. What can I learn from having faith, losing faith, learning to respect faith, embracing the absurd, and thus embracing life? Camus, through the myth of Sisyphus, if you'll recall from the last episode, extols us to say yes to life, as Nietzsche did, and as we'll see today, Soren Kierkegaard did. So our foundation for discussing this episode is, what can we learn from faith? Is faith useful? Let's begin, shall we? The cold open. We are introduced, in medias res, to two lovers doing what lovers do. As with the pilot, the camera work is good. The sets and stagings are good, too. There's a twist on our perceptions, as what we first think is an apartment is actually a furniture store. The couple finish their rendezvous, the woman leaves, and the man, we discover, is the security guard for the store. We see clearly that the woman is wearing a cross. The pacing in the scene is nice. I mean, we all know something bad is going to happen. It's the cold open of any cop show. This is where we see the murder of the week that our detectives have to investigate. Nevertheless, the camera work and the editing keeps us engaged, moves us from moment to moment, giving us all the little clues that we need. It's clear without being too obvious or hand-holding. The woman goes back to her car, the security guard is in the shop, and the shop has all of the TVs on for some reason. I mean, it's after hours, the store is closed, why would all the TVs be on? They're simultaneously playing a horror movie, and I get it, it's for effect, but I really just couldn't get over that idea. I mean, they all even have the sound on. Anyway, there's a slight jump scare, and then we get to the opening credits. Soren Kierkegaard lived from 1813 to 1855 in Denmark. He's often considered the father of existentialism. He wrote extensively about Christianity and faith in God. He believed that Christianity was not a dogma to be taught, but an experience to be had. For this episode, I read Fear and Trembling from 1843, Either Or from the same year, with a second part written a few years later, and Sickness Unto Death from 1849, along with some secondary sources and selections from his other writings, and just a little bit of Sartre, too. Which is why my scripting and recording for this episode has taken much longer than I had hoped. Because somebody will want to point this out, yes, I know, Kierkegaard was Lutheran, and this episode of Forever Night was specifically set in a Roman Catholic church. Do I care? Not really. This episode is really about faith, not a specific religion. The Catholic Church setting makes sense to Nick's past and means they got to shoot in what looks like a real church. Now, I looked up the church mentioned in the show, St. John's, and what I saw on Google didn't really look like what was in the show, but they definitely had shots of a real cathedral, it seems. So I think I may need to just take a road trip to Toronto and check it out. After we turn from the opening titles, we jump right into the action. Nick's Cadillac pulls up to the Raven, and I tingle with nostalgic glee. It's an early 1990s TV-sanitized industrial club, with generic music and people in black leather and bad haircuts growling and flailing around the dance floor. There's some kind of territorial growling at Nick, who's 800 years old and thus unimpressed. He makes a snarky comment about some punk kid's bad breath. Now, during this series, we will be dealt out little bits of this universe's lore here and there, I think, anyway. It's basic gothic vampire stuff, nothing too different from what you'd expect. I do kind of hope there'll be some explanation on whether there's some kind of vampire hierarchy, some kind of power structure. Later in this episode, Jeanette will throw her weight around, indicating that she's in a position of authority over another vampire. And in this scene, Nick becomes bemused at the younger vamp growling at him, suggesting he doesn't see the guy as a threat in any way. And of course, Lacroix, last episode, seemed to have no small amount of power and sway. This indicates that there's some kind of power structure. I can only assume it has to do with the age of the vampire, because Nick hasn't been in Toronto for more than 3 years, and Jeanette there even a shorter period of time. Anyway, it was just something I thought about in this scene. Not that I want some kind of Vampire the Masquerade thing in Forever Night, but all the same. Nick's there to talk to Jeanette, and he does, and it's very sensual and very close, and I'd call it sexual tension, but it's not really tense when it's so obvious. He talks to her about a series of murders in the city. So far, brutal, violent killings of two people. "You're not people," Jeanette reminds him. "You cannot deny what you are." So this line links Jeanette to Lacroix, who, last time we saw him, was a pile of ashes in Nick's burning apartment. By the way, there will be no mention of that in this episode. When we go to Nick's place in this episode, there's no indication of a fire or anything amiss. Anyway. So is Jeanette going to be the Lacroix stand-in until he returns? Nick's reminder of his inhumanity, his temptation to fully give in to his murderous desires. Before we can muse on that any longer, in comes Skanky. Now, I do love the color palette of the show. One of the few details I remember from watching in the 90s, the rich blues and greens in the shadows, the fiery reds and oranges in the highlights. Skanky makes like he's all cool and sexy, which is funny. There's some banter. Nick derides Skanky for going into the Raven because it's dangerous, which is also funny because I've seen scarier looking people at a Hot Topic than the mall rats we saw in the Raven. The detectives get a call, another murder. So this brings us to the victim from the cold open. She's been crucified, nailed down to the blacktop of the parking lot. Nick gets emotional, really emotional. He has these spurts of melodrama that are really pronounced, and I wonder if it's the actor or the director making this call. This episode has different writers and directors than the first one did, so maybe that's just how Garantwin Davies wanted to play it. I don't know. It's really uneven, though. The boyfriend is there, naturally a suspect, though Nick doesn't think he did it. The scene is awkward. The flow and good camera work from before is gone. The angles are weird. And the blocking doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Next scene, we're in a medical examiner's room with Natalie. So Natalie takes a cross from the neck of the victim and confirms that the other victims also wore crosses. Some checking on her part indicated that the victims were all Catholic and went to St. John's Church. So, Natalie did the checking. Shouldn't, like, you know, a detective do that? I mean, it does make sense, I guess, that Natalie would see the common jewelry all of them were wearing, but shouldn't that just be like a note in her report that the detectives follow up on? I mean, I'm not a cop. I'm not a Canadian cop, and I'm not a Canadian vampire cop, so far as you know. So maybe I'm washed up here, but anyway. Either way, we learn that Nick can't get too close to crosses. They make him feel weak. And the next scene is a church, presumably St. John's. But before we get to that scene and the introduction of our killer, I want to pause to consider something. In the book Fear and Trembling, Soren Kierkegaard writes, quote, "He who loves God without faith reflects upon himself. He who loves God believingly reflects upon God," end quote. And a little later in that same book, he goes on to say, quote, "Faith, therefore, is not an aesthetic emotion, but something far higher, precisely because it has resignation as its presupposition. It is not an immediate instinct of the heart, but is the paradox of life in existence," end quote. For Kierkegaard, faith, and I mean true faith, is not a matter of dogma or ritual. It's certainly not a matter of tradition or being born into a religion. For him, faith is first and foremost a matter of choice. This choice is not rational. It cannot be come to through rational means, because faith itself is not rational. True faith is an embrace of paradox, fully investing in the impossible. Blind faith is unacceptable for Kierkegaard. Faith is a choice that must be made with one's eyes fully open, fully cognizant of the choice being made. What I believe is impossible, and I embrace this paradox fully. Anxiety, for Kierkegaard, is the dizziness of freedom. For Kierkegaard, faith must be constantly renewed. One doesn't just accept religion and live in a state of unwavering conviction. Even the biblical Abraham had to be tested through God's demand that he sacrifice his one beloved son, Isaac. It was because he was so tested that Abraham is considered the father of faith. So let's go back to the episode. We're in a confession booth in the church. The priest looks super young. We don't see the killer's face when he enters the booth and starts his monologue about cleansing the church. The priest tries to tell him that God doesn't want him to punish the sinful. God wants sinners to turn to God themselves. The killer says, "I am the arm of God. I am his fury." The priest tries to confront the killer to stop him, but he runs off before the priest can see his face. So here the priest is about to have his own test of faith. His religion, Catholicism, holds the ritual of confession to be sacrosanct. The pact between the priest and the confessant cannot be violated for any reason. But the priest now has very serious reason to believe that if he holds to the letter of this law, a person will be murdered. The priest is being tested. In Kierkegaard's terms, he experiences a conflict between his ethics and his religion. The ethical dimension demands social responsibility. The priest should inform the police, or at least cooperate with the police when they investigate and ask him about confessions in the church, as they do later on in the show. But though the priest struggles with this deeply, he holds true to his religion. As with the Kierkegaard example of Abraham being commanded to kill his son, when the religious dimension comes into conflict with the ethical one, for a person of faith, the religious commandment must win, even if it means being unethical. But in both the case of Abraham and the priest, this is a personal choice. Only Abraham can decide to make the long journey to Mount Moriah. God does not force him to. Only the priest in our story can make the choice to stay faithful to his commandment and not divulge the contents of confession. Abraham, in Kierkegaard's telling, fully understands the heavy weight of what he is being commanded to do, to accept his son's blood on his hands, to rip away his greatest joy. And Abraham follows the command in complete faith, against reason, against ethics. He takes the leap of faith with no guarantee from God that there will be any sort of satisfying or righteous ending for him. So the priest in this episode must accept the consequences of his chosen inaction. Another woman may die because his God essentially commands him to be silent. Anxiety, indeed. In our next scene, we're in Nick's place and he's taking garlic pills. This is on Natalie's prescription, part of his treatment to make him human, which really just seems like some kind of aversion therapy. I'll have more to say on that later. Nick takes the pills and he has a major freak out. He sort of trips, writhes in pain, gasps, and thrashes around. Given the theme of the episode, I wonder if this is some kind of reference to self-harm as penance, although they don't make that connection explicitly in the episode. He gains control of his senses and starts sorting through evidence bags he's brought home from the station. So, is that a thing? Can detectives just take home evidence? Then we have a flashback. We're in the Middle Ages on actually a nice-looking Gothic set. A cocky Nicholas, all swagger and menace, comes into the room behind a young woman kneeling in prayer. He's a killer. We can see it in his stride. He confronts the young woman, who is Jeanne d'Arc, because of course she is. She will be executed soon. Jeanne says, "You who choose to live forever, live in constant fear of death." Yeah, thank you, Jeanne. That's actually what I've been saying. So, Nick is in despair. We see it in this flashback, although it's more pronounced in his present-day form. In this dialogue with Jeanne, we see him fighting a war with himself. His arrogance falters in the face of her faith. He chose to become a vampire. The series hasn't explained why yet. I assume Nick thought his transformation would heal him of some wound or cause him to transcend the human condition. Lacroix says in episode 2, "I made you a god." So now Nick is a despairing being, a god of despair. Nick sought to become something else, to escape. But his vampiric transformation was unsatisfying, and now he seeks a return. He wants to be rid of himself as he is, to go back to a previous self, but that self being past no longer exists. He idolizes a memory, not a reality. Fleeing from dissatisfaction as he does suggests Nick may be in what Kierkegaard would suggest an aesthetic mode of life. Kierkegaard identified 3 modes of living, or lifestyles, if you prefer, the aesthetic, the ethical, and the religious. Although to be artful and poetic, I was really hoping I could make the argument it was an analogous figure to Kierkegaard's concept of the Knight of Faith, because Nick was a knight in the Crusades, and how fucking perfect would it be for me to make a claim that he was a knight of faith? But he's not. He's not. Nick is an aesthete. A person in the aesthetic mode is dedicated to personal gratification. A person can do this and be perfectly moral and ethical, by the way. An aesthete person can even be religious, although those things are not necessary to being an aesthete. It's a matter of priority. The aesthetic will prioritize the life of self-satisfaction over the purely ethical or strictly religious. Pursuing the pleasurable is also to deny or run away from that which causes pain and discomfort. The liability of the aesthetic life is boredom. Constantly indulging self-satisfaction quickly leads one to a place where they cannot satisfy any desire anymore. One becomes jaded, dissatisfied. This pain of dissatisfaction causes the aesthete to pursue further pleasures, chasing his tail, as it were. It's a life that's self-defeating. This is Nick. He became a vampire. He pursued the hedonistic drives of that state, probably feeling freed from human morality, like he had slipped the bounds of the ethical and dogmatic. Nick and his brood indulged and wandered, sowing chaos and pain without care or concern for anyone but themselves. But now, after centuries, Nick finds himself unable to find joy, even a shallow kind, in his existence. In Sickness Unto Death, Kierkegaard writes, quote, "When death is the greatest danger, one hopes for life. But when one becomes acquainted with an even more dreadful danger, one hopes for death. So when the danger is so great that death has become one's hope, despair is the disconsolatest of not being able to die. This despair is self-consuming, but does not consume. The pain of despair is constantly reasserting itself." So back from the flashback, and we're in Nick's lair, and he opens one of the evidence bags. I don't think that's allowed. And he pours a cross from one of the victims into his hand. He holds it briefly, but it burns him, and he has to drop it. So, yeah, gross misconduct in regard to the evidence. That cannot be proper protocol there. And yes, I know, it's dramatic. This isn't a procedural. But if you're going to have your vampire cop be a cop, then he has to do cop stuff. Anyway. There's an Easter pageant being prepared for at St. John's. The young priest approaches the older priest to discuss the disturbing confession and his concerns that the confessant may kill someone. The older priest is adamant. The sanctity of the confession is paramount. We must follow God's will. So the young priest seeks validation of his choice and brusquely is told to keep silent, but this is not reassuring. So at the risk of mashing different theologies, let's consider what Kierkegaard has to say on this matter. Obviously, as a Lutheran, his concept of God's will is going to be quite different from a Roman Catholic one. But for Kierkegaard, faith is not dogma. It's individual and is lived subjectively. It is not a social relationship. For the faithful, it should be irrelevant if he is the only Christian on earth or one of millions, because only the one, the individual, can choose or reject faith. For Kierkegaard, this means that the mediation of clergy is unnecessary, even a hindrance to faith. Now, obviously, that's more of a Lutheran stance than a Catholic one. But nevertheless, we see the young priest struggle with his decision, and we can take it as a struggle within himself. After all, if he were blindly following church doctrine, there would be no conflict. The matter would be decided. But as Kierkegaard notes, the freedom of choice engenders a heavy responsibility, and from that, anxiety and dread. We come back into the episode of The Raven. Generic rock music thumps in the background, and in strides Don Skanky, looking to score. He'd insinuated to Nick earlier in the episode that even though he was married, he was still on the prowl, still a ladies' man. Nick shrugged him off, and now Donnie's looking to show himself, really, that he's still got what it takes. So this is a theme in the episode, people who claim they are one thing, but whose actions display something else. The murder victims were all regular attendees at St. John's, but they were also having affairs or engaged in work deemed immoral. This is presented as a hypocrisy, according to the killer, punishable by death. Skanky is a married, middle-class stiff, kind of schlubby, and he struts around with a thin ego that veils a deeper insecurity about himself and his virility and masculinity. I mean, that's how I read the character anyway. He wants, to some degree, to be a bad boy, the rough, manly type who sleeps around and doesn't care. Or rather, he wants that aesthetic, the associated cultural value of masculinity that comes with it. He doesn't really want to cheat on his wife. He doesn't really want to sacrifice his reality for the fiction. But nonetheless, he's here in The Raven. So Skanky dances, and I use that term loosely. He gets mind-tricked by a vampire girl. She leads him into the back room. So we cut from that scene to Nick as he meets the priest. They're outside at night, really nice-looking church in the background. Like I said, I Googled St. John's in Toronto, and the images that I saw didn't really look like this, so I don't know if it's the same location. There's a brief exchange between Nick and the priest, and then we cut back to Skanky and the vamp girl. At this point, he's hypnotized, basically in a stupor. Vamp girl starts undressing him. Jeanette storms in and stops the vamp girl just before she sinks her teeth into Donnie. Skanky seems to wake up from his haze, and Jeanette warms him off. Skanky takes the reference to risk to be a reference to STIs, and this is likely a sly way of suggesting the threat of HIV, although nothing is directly said. He hightails it out of the club. Cut to 1990s TV tropes. We're in the interior of a call center. Loose lips, sex line. Brilliant. One of the women working there is wearing a cross. Our next victim, Magda. She gets a call directly to her line. It's the killer. "You profane the church by feeding the fires of lust," he says. She gets freaked out and she leaves. There's some nice camera work in the hallway, actually. The first part of the scene does a good job of building tension. And then it kind of falls to shit. So Nick has super hearing. He happens to be driving by and hears the attack on Magda. This is supposed to be tense, but the way it's shot, it isn't really tense scene running through the back alleyways. There's a confrontation. Nick gets shot in the scuffle. He yells at somebody to stop, and it's the priest. Oh my gosh, what's he going to do? It turns out the priest wanted to warn Magda, the victim, but why did he shoot? Was it the killer who shot? It wasn't the priest. The editing in the scene was just bad. I had no idea what was happening, and I was super confused with the reveal of the priest. At the police station in an interrogation room, Nick lays into the priest, but the chief calls him back. The priest says the church grants salvation. Flashback time. Nick saunters up to Jeanne. "I can give you a life that never ends," he offers. But she is steadfast and righteous. Faith, she says. Pure, simple faith. By the way, I found her delivery flat and totally uninteresting. I don't know if that's her fault or bad direction or what, but I just did not give a crap about Jen here. I do like Geraint Wyndavies as a medieval vampire. I guess the melodrama doesn't feel as out of place next to lancet windows and vaulted ceilings. I like seeing him all dark and menacing. I think it gives modern Nick Knight some context. I'm sure we'll see more through the series, but I kind of want to see more Nick the Killer, Nick the Merciless. Give me some contrast to Drama Queen Nick. Anyway, in the exchange with Jean, we see he admires her strength in the face of death. He's awed by her faith and courage. But of course, Nick is not a man of faith. He's in despair. According to Kierkegaard, a despairing person seeks a self which he is not. He really seeks to tear the self away from what constituted it. Quote, to be self as he wills would be his delight for the despairing man. But to be compelled to be self as he does not will to be is his torment, namely that he cannot get rid of himself. End quote. So Nick is caught between faith and despair. He cannot let go of his despairing to embrace the paradoxes of fate, indeed the paradox of his own very condition. He's a vampire seeking redemption. Embrace the absurdity. Kierkegaard explains that Abraham believed in the absurd, had full confidence in the paradox of faith. Nick does not. Back in his lair, Nick has the medieval cross he got from Jean. Side note, in vampire stories, we often see that the vampires have their entire collections from across the centuries with them in their homes. Like, for real, how do you store and transport all that stuff? Hundreds, even thousands of times over nearly a millennium. Anyway, Natalie's there and awed by the story Nick tells. Nick stays away from the cross. So Natalie asks, why are you all so afraid of it? And Nick replies, because it's a symbol of the one true light, and we are creatures of the dark. So, creatures of the dark. But only so by choice, right? Nick embraced the darkness. At least at this point in the series, we have not been told that he was brought across against his will. A sinful choice, to be sure, but one deserving of eternal damnation? Kierkegaard would say no, since he believed that no sin is unforgivable by God. In fact, that's the paradox of faith. No sin is unforgivable by God, but God cannot or will not make one accept that forgiveness. Kierkegaard would say the opposite of sin is faith. Indeed, the Bible says that too, Romans 14:23, all that is not faith is sin. God is not external, like a policeman, but rather internal to all of us. Quote, the self has the conception of God, end quote. When Nick denies his faith, he's denying his connection to the divine and thus rejecting himself. This sickness in the self is the sickness unto death. Eternity only asks one question of every one human being. Have you lived in despair? So it's the next day and Nick is outside. Wait, what? It's daytime. Nick's outside. It's clearly daylight out. Dialogue tells us it's supposed to be pre-dawn, about 6 a.m. But I don't know. It looks pretty light out to me for pre-dawn. Anyway, it's a stakeout. They have Magda in protective custody, but they think the killer will be coming to the church to look for her. So Nick is in the church. Of course he is. They're going to put the vampire in the church, right? It's empty at first, so early in the morning. He has a bit of a freak out, starts flailing around the church, crosses on one side, sunlight in the windows. He hides in a confessional booth where the side where the priest sits. A repentant comes in, a little old lady. Nick pretends to sleep. The woman kindly leaves him be. Meanwhile, the killer is at the Easter display across the street on his own stakeout. Skanky goes to confession, upset about his almost indiscretion at the Raven. Nick puts on an Irish accent to fool him, and it's a funny scene. And there's absolutely no tension whatsoever regarding the fucking serial killer stalking the streets. 20 Hail Marys for laughing. We see Magda in protective custody. Is she flirting with the cop? What? All right, it seems like she was trying to make him uncomfortable so he would leave, and she escapes. Back at the church, the priest confronts Nick for his confessional shenanigans, actually physically shoving him around a church and in front of an altar where the weakened Nick finally passes out. Time passes. Skanky is staked out on the street and sees Magda, but immediately, I mean immediately, gets one punched out by the killer. Of course he does, because either the killer has a cloak of invisibility or Skanky has no peripheral vision. Magda goes into the church, and she sits in the pews. It's after dark now, and the church is empty. Why Nick isn't keeping an eye out there, I don't know. Before we know it, she's captured. Now, wait just one fucking second. How did the killer knock her out, pick her up, carry her out the front door and across the street with no one seeing her? Like, no one. Does Toronto just stop being a city after sundown? So the killer, apparently his plan is to burn Magda at the stake, which the stake is the cross that's being put up for the pageant. All of this is happening really quickly. Nick comes rushing out of the church. He flies across the street. There's a tussle with the killer and fire, very similar to episode 2. Suddenly it gets really foggy. I mean, damn, Toronto, you got a real fog problem. Nick leaps through the flames to get Magda and gets her just in time. Leap. Leap of faith, get it? He saves Magda. Magda. Magdalene. Do you get it? Wrap-up time. At the station, the killer is in custody. We don't hear his story, really. We don't get any glimpses into his twisted point of view. Honestly, for a show about a serial killer who brutally mangles his victims for religious fanaticism, this program doesn't give two shits about the perp. He's barely even shown. Magda, in her wrap-up, is showing us she's a righteous person. She offers forgiveness to the would-be killer and gives Nick a cross necklace. He tries to refuse, but she insists and puts it into his hand. He walks to Natalie in the office and shows her the necklace in his hand, and she's taken aback. You're able to hold it. Now, this is a busy scene with lots of people milling around, and Skanky's in the background filing some paperwork. Nick and Nat are close together, but this just seems like a bad place to have a conversation about how he's a vampire. Anyway, Nick is holding the cross and says, it burns, but not as badly. Who knows? Maybe I'm a step closer. Natalie asks, to God or mortality? Nick replies, maybe both. This should have been the end. Nick says, maybe both, then cut the black. But no. If that had been the very last line of dialogue, if the very last thing said in this episode had been Natalie asking Nick if he was closer to either God or mortality, very interesting to me that she poses those as oppositional. And Nick says, maybe both. And then it immediately cuts to black and runs the end credits. Then this may have been my favorite fucking piece of TV ever made. But no. They ruin it. They string the scene out for a pointless minute or so with a bit of banter from Skanky. Ugh. Remember the underlying theme. Unsatisfying endings. So close to glory. I will now follow their example and keep talking. So Natalie posits two goals. Being closer to God or closer to mortality is an either-or situation. Nick doesn't accept the either-or, but suggests, maybe flippantly, that he can have both. That he can become closer to God through faith, and closer to mortality, either through his faith and a miracle in God, or maybe he means through Natalie's interventions. Perhaps to Nick, the miracles offered by faith and the cures offered by Natalie are basically the same. He is from the Middle Ages, after all. He may have a rather mystical view of science. And while Natalie is a scientist, she's one in a fictional universe where vampires and, I presume, other paranormal creatures exist. She's supposing that her aversion therapies will essentially retrain Nick's physiological responses, and that this, somehow, will bring about his physical and spiritual transformation back into human form. And that really doesn't sound very scientific to me. I mean, why does she think that? Still, it seems to work a little in Nick's case. He's not as strong as other vampires. He can hold crosses now. He can tolerate garlic, although only barely. He's gone long periods without drinking human blood, so either through Faith, or Natalie's treatments, or a combination of both, maybe Nick is closer to both God and mortality. Nick's quest is for salvation. He thinks that salvation can only come, first of all, with a return to a state of being mortal and human. He seems to think, this is not explicitly stated, that he cannot atone while presumably a soulless vampire. Now, so far in the series, they've spoken about him becoming human again, no direct reference to a soul. Nick sees Faith as possibility. It is impossible for a vampire to hold a cross without being burned, but Nick can. Salvation is the most impossible thing of all, but it is possible, according to Kierkegaard, through God. This is the fight of faith. It fights for possibility. Resting in this paradox is faith. When Natalie says to God or to mortality, she's being a materialist. She sees proofs in material results. She obviously accepts the paradox of supernatural creatures of the night coexisting in her world of science and modernity, but she treats Nick's vampirism as a condition of the body, a sickness to be treated. She's trying to get him closer to mortality, which for her is a return to a natural or healthy state for Nick. God is something mystical. Now, maybe Nat is a believer in God, maybe she's not. It doesn't really matter. Like a person in Kierkegaard's ethical phase, she looks to serve a greater good that is rationally defined and socially constructive. By curing Nick, she feels she is helping him to be better. When Nick says, maybe both, it's on the one hand a defiance of Natalie's material concerns for his body, and an understanding that his condition is not medical, it's spiritual, or if you prefer, existential. The crosses burned him not because of their material properties, but because of what they symbolized. The vampire exists in a liminal space between the material and the spiritual, the symbolic made manifest. This is the very locus of his despair. On the other hand, Nick does not reject Natalie's treatments, though he seems to doubt them. He also doesn't drop to his knees in the church and beg for salvation, taking the risk of destruction to embrace faith, to embrace the impossible, that even he could be forgiven. He says he wants mortality, but does he really? Sometimes when we've run out of vices, when our pleasures run shallow and our joy seems fleeting, one will resort to self-harm just to feel anything. Perhaps not even consciously, Nick blinds himself to the paradox of his own being. He submits himself to Natalie's experiments, not because he actually wants to be cured, but because he wants to be punished for his not wanting it. Or maybe both. Quick postscript. Thanks everyone for indulging me on this. Truth is, I have pages and pages of notes about Kierkegaard's interpretation of the sacrifice of Isaac and the night of resignation and the night of faith that just didn't make it into the episode. I'll tell you, initially I didn't like this episode. I thought it was weak and really poorly executed. But I tell you, I really enjoyed reading Kierkegaard. So I guess this is one of the benefits of unsatisfying endings. Not the ending itself, but where it leaves you, and how you understand where you've been left in the middle of your own forever night. Let's pause for a word from our sponsor. Still Dreaming is a podcast hosted and recorded by me,
in the newly revamped CERK Internet Radio Studio. Forever Night was produced for CBS by Glenn Warren Productions and Sony Pictures Television. All rights reserved.